We should be all right. So my name's Mary Caldor, and I run a program we have here at the LSE called the Conflict Research Program. And this is something funded by the Department for International Development. And we're supposed to study the drivers of conflict and what might work as interventions. And the drivers of conflict is mostly what we study, which are terrible things like systematic corruption, like ethnic sectarianism, religious fundamentalism. But actually, what we find in every single one of our sites is something different, which is there are people who really try to act in the opposite way to these logics of violence. And it seems to us that if we try to study them and find ways to identify them, that might be a better way. But even if it isn't a better way, I just think there's something very heartening about hearing these different types of stories from conflict zones and the incredible bravery that people go through in these areas and the kinds of things they do to keep everyday life together. Although not all the examples we're going to talk about are at the level of everyday life, they're at the level of politics, they're even at the level of the international community. So I'm going to everybody here around the table are researchers from our conflict sites. So our conflict sites are South Sudan, Somalia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Syria and Iraq, but we only have three cases here, although I think there might be people from Iraq and South Sudan in the audience if they want to add to this. But I thought we'd start with Somalia, which is one of the most difficult places. And what I thought was, because we've sat all day discussing civicness and listening to presentations, I would ask each of the speakers questions and we'd try to have more of a conversation involving you as well. I'll start with a question and then we can involve everybody else. So my first question is to Khalif, who is one of our field officers from Somalia. And Khalif is somebody who comes from Somalia but has spent a lot of time in the UK and somehow crosses the boundary of transnational activism. And I'm going to ask Khalif really to tell us a little bit about his own experiences of civic activism. Yeah. No. It was me shouting. Can you shout? Because you talk very quiet.
It is working. It is apparently working. So yeah,
okay. Try. Well, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's fine. I'll first tell you about myself a bit, where I grew up, which made me up.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So I then will tell you the few things I did that counters activism. I'm told. I started in life in a garrison town with a lot of Ethiopian soldiers guarding over Somalis who thought these guys were in the wrong country. Close to it, I remember, to the east of it, was a graveyard, a large graveyard with more population than the people living in the town, called the Graveyard of the Cousins. Who were people who died in a fight in just few, in 1963-64 revolt against the Ethiopians. This just set the scene where I started life. My father left school in Somalia to participate in that revolt. When that was quelled, he then settled in that town and started having a small shop, and on the side traded in livestock, which he bought throughout the year and then just sold them in the high seasons where he could sell more. There was three lessons from him, three things he did mostly and lessons from him that went with me, I mean, throughout my life. The first one was a deep suspicion of any political or political or actually movement that talked about liberation and things like this, because he thought what will happen is that they create mayhem, a lot of people will die as a result. That's his thinking. And in the end, they will make a deal in which only the leaders benefit. He, I think, came to this conclusion in 1966, long before my birth. So that was one lesson. The second lesson is he helped people as much as he could. So one important example is, for example, as he's buying animals, people come to market wrong times, and they can't get what they want. The prices are too low. He'll buy from them at a high price, knowing that he will make money anyway. So people thought that he was making a lot of sacrifice, actually, but in reality, it was win-win all the time. So he used his business to help people, but he wasn't sacrificing much, really. And the second one is that he had very good network around the country to ease his trade. All these three, I found later, lessons to be very valuable. I came to UK, I just fast forward everything. So I came to UK before I turned 20, just 19. As soon as I came, there was an organization called Ogaden Action Group. The area that the Ethiopians were was called Ogaden. So Ogaden Action Group, run by people who looked to me elders, from the same area, so I joined them. And after a while, I found what my father was saying was right. That it was more about them rather than about the struggle of people or anything. So I decided to actually try to help myself by going to education, going to employment. After 5 years or so in employment, I thought that I was not useful to my community at all. So I've changed my ways to live within the community in Bristol, UK here. And the first project I got involved was a project in which the same population from the same area were thinking again what we could do to add back home. They were trying to push everyone to that project, but I refused, actually. I was reluctant. And this is a recurrent theme. You will find that in every activism or thing that I'm called to, I'm reluctant to go in first. So a few miss me, and then one grabs my attention in the end. So this one, they have accepted my terms, which were, actually, we're not going to deal with any movements like the ONLF or any organization that was already in the field. We will do things like information, which is a big gap. There was a change back home. That change was intentionally being blocked out by all the other groups to just say things as bad as they were always. So no information was coming in. There was no dialogue. So we thought, we called the organization Dialogue, or in Somali, Hajo, which we wanted, because we wanted just to inform people to do more dialogue within the community. The organization was successful in the first few months, and then we found out that some people started using it actually to get better positions back home. So we killed the organization so that no one else can use. We stopped there. Someone continued with the website, giving information, but I think most of us were not there. But in there, I gained actually a good friend who later called me to participate in what's going on in Bristol itself. And with him, we created, we created what's called Bristol Somali. It's Somali Resource Center. So whenever I remember Bristol, then it goes away. So Bristol Somali Resource Center, which is up to now actually the most enduring Somali organization there. We created the organization. It was to serve the Somalis there. And in the end, we left it when we thought that it was running and in good hands. And then before we actually left that organization, we found there was more need. the most pressing need the Somalis have, which all the research was saying, was a need for space. And in a particular area of Bristol, they didn't have a space. So to the extent that even the Church of England was there, was actually trying to help them with the space. And so we talked to the women, these groups who were the most affected because they were isolated. The men were going to coffee shops, they were going to work, and they were not that much isolated, but the women were really isolated. If you look at the Somali community, people think that they're all uniform, they're all from the same village. But actually, when you find like even 500, 600, 1,000 families, you'll find a lot of them come from different villages, different towns. And if they don't talk to each other, they don't know each other. So each one is isolated. So we found that was a real problem. And we talked to the woman. They said we needed actually a center with a mosque in it, because we're going to a mosque during Ramadan at night, and we're going through a danger. We're going through tunnels, dark places, and all that. So we first teamed up with the church around there, who was saying that we wanted to help as well. The church was so good that they even voted to share their church with us. The church was very old, but they had a new building adjacent to it. So they wanted to actually take down that and build a new purpose-built mosque. And we agreed that we'll have in between a cafe, so that people can see each other, and this was like a separation. But people turned against that, including the architect who wanted to build this. He said, no, his conscience doesn't allow him this. And many people were saying that actually they think this is not so good because this was old church. We were not taking over the church, but you know the rumors. People say they're taking over the church, the burial site, all that. So we thought that this project is getting into an area that we didn't want to get into. We didn't want to put the church into a trouble. So we said, let's go our separate ways. And we found a derelict building, a big factory that was not used in 3 years, not far from the place, within the area. So we started to negotiate with the owners of that. We had a real problem. Mary was talking about the bad activist today, or bad civicness. So we had a group of racists who had a Facebook called No Mosque in Barton Hill area, and they had 1,300 members from Wellington, New Zealand, all the way to Alaska, basically around the world. But they frightened the council. And the council officers said that they will actually send this to the council for a vote. So we have to do actually a lot of political work and have to canvass the support of a lot of communities, the Jewish communities, the Christian communities, all faith communities, and also all the civic activists around. In the end, it was proven that actually there was no support for this group locally. And we had a unanimous vote from the council. The project is still continuing. The community have been generous. And even up to now, it's actually running. And I was hearing that they've raised £500,000 to renovate it. And the renovation is finishing. So, and they bought the place. So that place is still running. That is one thing. Which was a lot of politics, a lot of support that we needed. The second thing I will move fast to is what happened recently. This is in the region itself. So both I and my friend moved back to the region, to the Horn of Africa. My friend joined the government in Somalia, I think, in 2013, and he's still there. I went back as a researcher in 2015, and in late 2018, things got worse in the same region, the Somali region of Ethiopia. There was basically a despot who was in charge, was killing people, silencing, and when people are silenced, the only people who are able to talk are the people outside the country. And now he had this method where if you talk, your mother will be in prison, or anyone relative to you will be in prison and calling you and saying, stop what you're doing, or else he'll be killing them. One of my friends who I knew refused to listen, and his brother was killed, his father was injured. A lot of his family were either exiled or actually imprisoned as well, or killed. So it was touching. It was a moment that he needed a solidarity. And as a form of solidarity, a lot of people came together. The country, Ethiopia, as a whole, was also changing. While that was going, we thought that we will help this person by getting as many people as possible talking, so that the guy who is killing people cannot do that, because it's not only one person, it's not two persons, it's a lot of people. That have worked kind of, because he was not targeting people because someone was talking any longer. But things were leading to each other. The country was changing fast, the president have changed it. And they did want to change him, but they didn't have the pretext. So we thought we move then to bring people together. And working with an organization from UK called Conciliation Resources, which was already working between the ONLF and the government, who recognized that there was no civic movement in the country. There was no space for civil society at all because of the fighting that was going on. Where have targeted few people that included me, and again reluctantly I accepted to participate. In the end, there was 30 people, I think, but then there were 7 of us remaining, which created actually an organization that they were not part of, in order to there was a lot of movement that was going on, but they were not targeted. So we thought we will unite them in a way on the targets, on the aims that they wanted to have. We'll try to, because there was also problems between them, so we try to iron out these problems between themselves. It worked for a while, but soon as it was clear that this person will be changed, well, they were eyeing for position, so it became really tougher. So we had a lot of meetings between them, coming to London, going back home, going to Ethiopia, trying to iron out things. But one thing, the aims were working. So we wanted to remove the guy, first of all. And one of the pretexts we wanted to create is to frighten him. We knew that when he was frightened, he will actually do something very drastic that will force the government to act. And one of the things they did was to have a meeting in Somali-dominated town close to him, and then to promise that they will move on the capital. When he heard that, he started killing the non-Somalis in town, and also talking about cessation, which the Ethiopian constitution allows, but it's actually only a constitution that's not implemented. So the government started, and they attacked him, and they removed him. Now, as soon as they removed him, we really lost our grip on anything. No one was listening. Everyone was eyeing for the position, so people just ran it and stampeded. And I think our organization stopped functioning from there. So the lesson here, I think, in the end, is that civic movements can only work to some extent. When there is actually really working systems, institutions that to anchor to, but if there's none and people are only looking for positions, so many people who even come to you in the end will be enticed to come to positions. So even when we were holding meetings, one of the current leader now actually called me asking me to just stop the meetings, because he thought we were trying to say, okay, the people have to agree between themselves who's going to lead them. And he thought the government will select him. So he wanted to leave it to the government. So he wanted to stop the whole movement in order to strengthen his position. And I'm sure he enticed a lot of people the same way. So when we saw this stampede, we thought, okay, we've got the first part, which is to remove the guy. We can't get the second guy. We have to realize that this is not in our grip. So I think I'll stop here, and you get the message.
you. I don't know which of these things to use. Thank you. And I'm sure we'll come back because there are more stories to be told. But in a way, what one might argue is the problem with conflict zones is that it's very, very difficult to be civic. So now I'm going to turn to Rimi Turkmani, who is Syrian and runs our Syria research program. Like Khalifa, she's a transnational citizen. She's Swedish because she did her PhD in Sweden in physics. But when the war broke out, she felt she had to contribute to civil society in Syria. And I'm going to ask her about something very specific because she, as a transnational citizen, she has been able somehow to act as a bridge between the ground and the international level. And so she's played a real role in trying to bring civil society into the United Nations talks in Geneva. So I'm going to ask her to tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, thank you very much, Mary. So can you hear me? So Mary told you that in all the conflict zones that we study, there are always examples of a civicness and that we try to study them and research them. What she didn't tell you is that she actually also helped them and helped to promote them and take their cause to a much higher level. And what I'm going to tell you, the stories I'm going to tell you is an example of that. So by 2013, the image in Syria was really very, very frustrating for civil society and for people who want to promote civic values in Syria. What started as civic movement suddenly is a, you know, the chaos. You have a very violent a conflict, lots of geopolitics, all the regional countries interfered. You have Russia also interfering, the US. And it was just very, very nasty arena. You really don't want to stick your head up and do something political in the middle of all of this. The opposition, the formal opposition, became mainly exile opposition, very weakly connected to the ground. I mean, you're talking about an authoritarian regime where we did not have a true political movements, you know, evolving anyway. So we wouldn't have expected to have true political representative movements. So in the middle of all of this, we knew that there's so many, despite everything, there's so many amazing stories on the ground. I mean, I can tell you numerous stories. Maybe I'll just, before going about how we went up to Geneva, I'll tell you a few examples of, despite everything, and despite that back then, if you looked at the map of Syria, you will see like, you know, bits and pieces after under different controls. This one is under opposition, this is under government, this is Kurdish forces, this is ISIS. So despite this, actually, the people on the ground were working across conflict line together. And there's numerous examples. To just bring some to the pictures, I'll talk about the one organization that I worked with called the People of Aleppo, or Ahali Halab. So these guys were, yeah, working in the city of Aleppo, and which became divided to West and East Aleppo. So the one part is controlled by the opposition, another part is controlled by the regime. But every time the infrastructure falls apart, like you have a broken water pipeline or sewage or electricity, somebody needs to be able to cross the conflict line and fix it. You just cannot just fix it in one part without crossing the other line. So these people came together in Aleppo, and they have contacts on both sides, and they managed to convince the municipalities to give them the vehicles they needed to fix the infrastructure, and they started crossing the lines, fixing the water pipelines, the sewage, the electricity, and making everyone happy. But with this, they insisted they want peace. So I'd say, fine, we're going to fix the power line, the electricity, but only if you agree that this zone will be peaceful. You're not going to be fighting over the game. We don't want you to, you know, if we fix the water pipeline, for example, that bombs will fall into this area again. So with their interventions, which are very technical, they brought peace as well. And in one interesting occasion, we had ISIS occupying part of Aleppo, and you probably cannot imagine a more brutal actor, right? And at some point, ISIS occupied the main power station of Aleppo, and they threatened that they're gonna just cut power for everyone, particularly those in government areas. So those guys stepped in, and they spoke to ISIS. And they managed to mediate an agreement between ISIS and everyone else, including the government, Well, they said, fine, look, we will help. We will, you know, if the power station continue to function, everyone will benefit. So they mediated a deal where the people who can run the power station, because they convinced ISIS that they cannot run the power station themselves. They do need the technical expertise that are in the government area to come in and operate the station. So they convinced them that they can bring those people in who know how to operate the power station only under the condition that they will allow the electricity also to go to all areas. And they managed, and they, you know, that they got even a written deal with ISIS stamp on it that actually, you know, as a result of this deal, you know, the city had electricity, yeah? They had another experience with Jabhat al-Nasr, which is also Al-Qaeda-associated organization, got hold of the major water plant in Aleppo, which Aleppo had the Leishmania, a kind of virus in its water, so you always have to have lots of chlorine in the water. Again, they stepped in, they negotiated a deal where they were allowed to take all the chlorine from the UN, go to the power plant and add the chlorine to the water to sterilize it. So everyone in Aleppo can have a clean water, yeah? Because Jabhat al-Nusra was convinced that there is no point that they kick everyone out of the water, the water plant, and they end up with water that is, you know, have this Leishmania virus. So anyway, knowing all these things on the ground and then looking up at the political process and seeing only exile opposition and armed groups and the regime taking place, it was very, very frustrating for those who wanted, you know, were wishing for a better outcome out of this conflict. So this is where we started campaigning for civil society to play more political role. So their job is not only to count the dead and deliver humanitarian aid and fix the pipeline. These people have vision and they need to be up at the highest level in Geneva. And I was looking around for somebody to help me to organize a conference to discuss what role can the civil society play politically. And Mary was there to help, actually. She stepped in and helped me organizing conference 2013 in Lebanon, where we had mainly civil society actors from all parts of Syria coming together, and we all agreed that we should play a political role in Geneva as well. So we took this to a highest level. We started going to Geneva, talking to the special envoy. Reluctantly, after a lot of pressure, back then it was Brahimi, he agreed to have a small group of people. He said, about 14 of us. He said, this is going to be sounding board of ideas. I'll listen to you. You know, okay, I will consult with you on various issues. Later on, he was replaced with Stefan de Mistura, who happened to also be a very good friend with Mary. And Mary helped us again to, you know, establish a relationship with him, where we went and visited him again and, you know, presented to him our recommendations, our asks, where we said, you know, we want to be part of this process. You know, this is a very exclusive process, and if you don't bring those people who have a civic vision, who really wants to see a functioning democratic country, there is not going to be a proper political process in Geneva. So if de Mistura was very, very recipient to the, and he received the idea very well, and he acted on it promptly, and he established what is now called as the Syrian Civil Society Support Room, which is a space that brings the Syrian civil society from all sides to Geneva. And we're talking, when we say civil society here, I don't mean only the CSOs. I mean, there were all kind of actors, civic actors, who do not necessarily identify with the opposition or with the regime. Some of them were previous government officials or ministers. Some are businessmen. They're technocrats. They are civil society organizations. So this kind of people who have civic vision, who behaved always in a very civic way, they were looking for that space, and they helped, you know, they were part of constructing this space in Geneva, and they were going regularly. Every time there are talks, they were invited, they will meet in a room about this size, and start talking about everything that is on the political table. And the amazing thing is that they were reaching consensus among each other about what do they want, despite that they come from completely different political backgrounds, different perspectives, different experiences. So when we had the political process that was going on for like 6-7 years with no progress to talk about, like not even the special envoy managing to bring the opposition and the regime together in one room, not even once. friends, and then those guys coming together, sitting, say, insisting that they have to sit with the other, they have to sit with those who they think they disagree with, and talk about all the issues, including the foundation principles of the future state, and agreeing on it. They were reaching agreements, they were building consensus, they were crossing all kind of conflict lines. And there's so many good stories that, you know, came out of this civil society support room. So we decided to have a research about it. I'm not gonna talk about it now in details, but if you go to the ePrints, the LSE ePrints website, you will find it. You either put my name or something, you will find the a long paper about this civil society support room, how it was constructed, what was the outcome, and the impact. At the same time, also, the women were also pushing for a role, and I was kind of part of that with many other women organizations. And we also managed to carve a place for ourselves in the political talks, and it's called the Women Advisory Board. So they couldn't find a formal way to engage us in the talk as a political actor, so we formed what they call the Women Syrian Women Advisory Board to the Special Envoy. So I go regularly to Geneva, where I get the opportunity with my colleagues to also sit with the Special Envoy, put all our ideas and thoughts on the table, and discuss it directly with him and all the other actors that are engaged in the conflict. So we think this is a success story for civil society in a conflict that can be copied in many other conflicts. We already try to now engaging with the Afghani experience and trying to, you know, get the European to push for something similar in Afghanistan. I will just end with just telling you what is it that revealed to us that what we've done was so important. Is the moment that the Geneva process tried to produce something very, very political, which is producing a constitutional committee to write the future constitution of the country, and the moment the Special Envoy tried to bring this civil society support room, which many thought it's a harmless process sitting there in Geneva, it's not interfering with politics, it's fine. The moment he decided to bring it in the middle of the constitutional committee and insisted that one-third of this committee should consist out of these civic actors, one-third the regime, one-third the opposition, one civic actors, that moment everyone just became very anxious and very worried, especially regional countries, especially Russia, especially the regime, and they started interfering. It's like, hold on, no, you're gonna have this and that, and why, and to which country do they respond? So suddenly we had, almost they spent entire year negotiating who's going to be, who are the 50 people in that civil society middle third that is going to be part of the constitutional committee. And this is where we realize the role that the civil society is going to play in this political process is extremely, extremely important. Sadly, as the result of all this interference, we lost about two-thirds of the list, so they replaced them with people who are, I would say, I wouldn't exactly describe them as member of the civil society. Some of them had to be directly reporting to the regime or very strongly linked to a particular state. But we kind of preserved one-third of the one-third. And still now, following their role in the constitutional committee, they have got about two meetings so far. There should be a meeting at the end of this month. We already observed that they, despite everything, they managed to change the discourse. They were the only ones who were talking about human rights, transitional justice, inequality, making everyone accountable in this process. And with that, they managed to change also the whole discourse in the Constitutional Committee. They were the only ones who were reaching out to everyone who was excluded from the process, because it is a very exclusive process. They were the only ones who were trying to cross the line and talk to those who are different, whether the regime and the opposition delegation remain kind of treating each other as enemies. So I'll end here.
Thank you very much, Reem. And actually, one thing you didn't mention, which I would add, is that I think one of the things you found was that it was really helpful to the position of civil society on the ground. The fact that they'd been to Geneva gave them more legitimacy locally. But even more importantly, because they came to Geneva, they could make specific links with donor agencies or whatever and say there's a problem in this place can you come and help us? So it created a new form of communication, which I think might have been the most important consequence.
Can I just because I like to talk about real examples. I mean, yes, I mean, they, of course, coming to Geneva elevated their status in general, especially that they were always changing the people. So it wasn't always the very same people being invited, right? But it gave everyone who came to Geneva, even once, they were much better connected now with all the actors, including the humanitarian ones. So we've got all kind of instruments related to Syria and Geneva. So they all go meet with them, have direct contacts. And in many occasions, they saved lives with these contacts, you know. So one example I'll bring is there is a village in Syria where suddenly became exposed. The opposition has to withdraw, and the people felt very, very exposed and protected, and they feared that there would be massacre if the regime just suddenly storms in. And they contacted through their Geneva connections. They were able to contact the special envoy, who then contacted the Red Crescent and the Red Cross in Syria, who just immediately went to that village. They remained there, and they were able to protect the people. And there's so many other examples. You're not going to hear about it, because usually this kind of story, people keep it under the radar.
Great, thank you. And now, finally, to our third, we have Emil Basuta. Basuta. I knew I would get it wrong. From Congo. He's going to speak in French, but Koen Vlassenroot, who's part of our Congo program from Ghent University, is going to translate for him. And my question, some of you may know that there were elections in 2018 and Kabila, who'd been in power, was replaced. And I'm going to ask Emil to tell us about what that meant for civic activism on the ground, what those elections meant.
Oui, je dois me mettre. Merci beaucoup, Marie, pour cette question. Juste pour commencer, il n'y a pas longtemps, je faisais mon doctorat en Belgique et je devais retourner chez moi voir ma famille qui était au Congo. Et l'université m'a dit que je ne devais pas retourner chez moi parce qu'il y avait la guerre.
Thank you, Mary, for having me. Before we start, just a personal anecdote. I started my PhD in Belgium, and when I was about to go back home and visit my family, my university told me it was too dangerous. There was a war going on.
Deuxième chose, il y a quelques mois, j'étais au Parlement européen après une réunion au gouvernement belge et on parlait des élections et les Belges et les Européens qui avaient mis un peu d'argent ont dit c'était un échec total.
Second anecdote, a couple of months ago, I was attending a meeting at the European Union, including presence of Belgian Foreign Affairs, and they told me that the Congolese elections were a total failure.
Oui. Alors, les deux exemples disent deux choses différentes. La première chose, c'est que souvent nous avons un imaginaire selon lequel, dans les pays où il y a la guerre, où il y a eu des conflits, il n'y a rien qui se passe. C'est un peu les imaginaires qu'on a lorsqu'on parle de Afghanistan, Afrique centrale, Afrique centrale, est du Congo, Soudan du Sud. On a l'impression que là, en termes de démocratie, de citoyenneté, il n'y a rien qui existe.
So these two stories tell two things. The first thing is that there is sort of an imaginary that nothing is working, nothing is functioning, that in countries like Afghanistan, Central African Republic, South Sudan, Eastern Congo, everything is in a total collapse.
Oui, c'est pour ça que mon université m'a refusé d'aller chez moi. Je devais participer à un mariage au Congo. Et donc, on oublie même que dans des contextes de guerre, il y a des mariages, des baptêmes, les gens vivent réellement. Et même chose au niveau de l'Union européenne et de la Belgique, on se dit, ben, les élections se sont mal passées et donc il n'y a rien qui existe.
So actually, what my university was telling me that I shouldn't go back to a place where nothing is working. But what we tend to forget is that and I was invited to attend a marriage, that life goes on, that marriages go on, and so on. A similar message was sent by the European Union at this union, telling that these elections were a total failure, despite the fact that they had co-funded the whole event. Nothing came out of it.
Mais cela veut dire quoi? Ça veut dire qu'il y a un problème de critères lorsqu'on parle de pays en guerre ou pays post-conflit, ou lorsqu'on parle des élections dans ces pays-là. Donc on a toujours un certain modèle selon que les élections ont pour objectif de mettre en place des dirigeants selon des critères reconnus internationalement.
So what is actually behind these stories is that we are often working with specific criteria about war, but also about elections. Elections are considered as good elections when they follow a specific model and they bring a regime change when people vote for a regime change, but at least that people are voted into government and parliament, but based on a very normative perspective on what elections should be.
Oui, mais en réalité, ce qu'on se rend sur, on va sur le terrain, qu'au-delà de cette idée qu'il y a la guerre, qu'il y a le chaos, il y a des choses qui se passent comme dans les élections au Congo. Ce qui s'est passé, c'est que depuis 2014, l'ancien président Kabila a tout fait pour gagner les élections, pour rester au pouvoir, comme il l'a vu au Rwanda, au Burundi, au Congo-Brazzaville, un peu partout en Ouganda dans la région. Et donc, il s'est battu pour remporter les élections.
In fact, there's another reality if we look closer at what is going on. One thing we tend to forget when looking at the elections is that since that things have happened before, and since 2014, President Kabila has tried everything to remain in office and do as what happened in Burundi and in Rwanda and Congo Brazzaville, where presidents were able to get a third term, and so Kabila did everything to stay in power. Oui. From 2014 onwards.
Oui. Donc, il a premièrement essayé de modifier la Constitution, ça n'a pas marché. Il a fait le glissement, c'est-à-dire de repousser le plus loin possible la date des élections. Il en est arrivé au bout. Et à la fin, il a essayé d'imposer un candidat qui n'a pas gagné des élections, malgré tout l'argent que Kabila a mis et toute la violence aussi derrière son candidat.
So Kabila did three things. First of all, he tried to change the constitution, which was leading to mixed results, but did not allow him to run again for presidency. Then afterwards, he tried what in Congo is so beautifully said as glissement. He has tried to keep that process as long as possible, really pushing it to the end to stay in power as long as he could, but also the end was there at some point. And then a third one, strategy was to select someone, as Emma said earlier today, the kind of Putin strategy, select someone to run for presidency who was so dependent from the president, from Kabila, that he would never be able to be independent or act as an independent president. And this person, Le Dauphin, the dolphin of Kabila, didn't make it either, despite the massive use of violence prior to the elections and the massive amounts of money being invested in this person's career.
Oui. Alors, la première chose à savoir, c'est que si, malgré tout ce que Kabila a réussi à faire, il n'a pas réussi à rester au pouvoir, c'est parce qu'il y a eu des organisations de la société civile, particulièrement Lucha Filimbi, qui étaient tout le temps dans les rues, qui ont été souvent assassinées. Et c'est grâce à cela et aussi la pression sur le plan international. Ce sont les deux facteurs qui ont fait à ce que, malgré sa violence, malgré sa fortune, il n'a pas réussi à se reconduire au pouvoir.
So there's two reasons why Kabila didn't, in the end, make it, why he didn't win this game, despite the high levels of violence being mobilized and the huge amounts of money being invested. The first one is the presence of civil society organizations, including Lucha and Filimbi, youth groups, some of whom were killed during their actions or who were put in prison, but have been on the streets all the time claiming for a change and for a respect of the constitution. And the second element explaining why Kabila failed was international pressure, which prior to the elections also included sanctions against a number of people from his regime. I'm adding a few things, but I think that's okay. Just to make the story about.
Oui. Mais après, il y a quelque chose quand même qui s'est passé qui est très intéressant. C'est que celui qui a gagné réellement les élections, ce n'est pas la personne qui a été proclamée. Et c'est la raison pour laquelle, je disais, l'Union européenne, la Belgique et la France, très maladroitement d'ailleurs, ont pensé que les élections, c'était un fiasco. Alors que la société civile, une partie de la société civile, était quand même plus ou moins satisfaite de ce qui s'est passé. Et la question, c'est de savoir pourquoi.
So a quite interesting thing happened. In the end, the one who won most of the votes did not take office. It was someone else who became the next president, the one who was second in the election. When you look at the election results, which explains why countries like Belgium, France, the US, and others say that elections were indeed a failure, a total fiasco. But quite strikingly, in contrast to the position of the international community, civil society organizations seem to be rather satisfied. So the question is, why is this?
Oui. Pourquoi? C'est parce que, comme je le disais au départ, on pense souvent les élections dans une perspective particulière liée à des critères internationaux en disant les élections ont pour objectif d'élire des dirigeants. Mais dans le cadre de la société civile au Congo, les élections avaient un but d'abord de mettre à la porte le président Kabila.
So there's a big contrast between the international reading of what elections should be. Elections are there to elect people in office and elect new leaders, which is the internationally approached perspective, international perspective towards elections. But in Congo, civil society claimed that elections were not there for that purpose, but to get rid of an old regime, to get rid of Kabila, instead of elect a new president.
Et je prends ceci très au sérieux parce que si vous voyez la situation au Burundi où on a eu des élections plus ou moins normales en 2010, au Rwanda où on a eu des simulacres d'élections souvent, on a des élections qui se passent mais il n'y a rien qui change en termes d'alternance. Mais au Congo, en fait, l'idée des élections, c'était de permettre de rendre quelque chose de nouveau possible. Hein? Et pour la société civile, c'est cette possibilité-là du changement, et pas nécessairement le changement, mais la possibilité du changement, c'est le plus important par rapport au processus électoral.
So the lesson from the Congolese elections, that in contrast to, for instance, Burundi, where we had elections in 2010, regular elections, several elections in Rwanda, or at least something that looked like elections. In both countries, these elections did not produce change. The main message and that from the DRC elections is, and that's something strongly supported by civil society, that it made people believe again that they can make a change, that they can change a regime when they don't like it.
Oui. Alors la deuxième chose, c'est qu'on a eu effectivement des élections qui n'ont pas amené la personne élue au pouvoir, mais quand même des élections où on a senti une évolution en termes de citoyenneté. Et là, je vais donner deux exemples. Le premier exemple, c'est que dans les élections passées, il y avait ce courant très favorisé par les organisations féministes en disant ben, il faut qu'on ait des femmes candidates au pouvoir. Hein, on a eu ça dans les années passées. Mais ici, pour ces élections, on a eu des organisations de femmes au Congo qui ont dit pour la première fois, on ne va pas voter pour les femmes qui ne méritent pas. Et donc, il y a un changement du discours sur la représentation quantitative des femmes vers une représentation qualitative de femmes. Et donc, même si on n'a pas eu la personne au pouvoir pour laquelle on avait voté, on a eu quand même une évolution par rapport à la manière de penser la représentation. Ça, c'est le premier exemple.
Two examples why these elections show that there is sort of an evolution towards the strengthening of civicness, which is called in Congo beautifully citoyenneté. First is that there is this call to elect women, which is also an internationally applauded call, that women should take over positions and should be more representative in parliament and government and so on. And a number of organizations, women organizations in Congo have said, no, that's not what we want. We are not going to vote for women or for people who do not deserve to be elected, and in this case to be re-elected. Many of those who were elected previously have lost the elections. I think about 60% are newcomers, which is actually saying that people wanted to make a change. They wanted to get rid of those who were there before and who didn't do their job. So there is a shift as part of the electoral process. There is a shift from a quantitative perspective, a number of women elected, to a qualitative perspective. People want to choose for those who deserve it.
Oui. Alors, le deuxième exemple, on a eu l'implication des groupes armés dans les élections. Et vous savez que sur le plan international, d'ailleurs, vous le savez, l'un des critères pour évaluer les bonnes élections, c'est la distance entre les bureaux de vote et les militaires et la police. Et au Congo, on a eu des élections où des groupes armés sont intervenus, parfois pour sécuriser le matériel électoral, parfois pour pousser la population à voter pour un certain candidat, alors qu'on avait dans le passé des groupes armés qui ne voulaient pas d'élections ou qui perturbaient la situation. Mais là, on a eu des groupes armés qui se sont intéressés au processus électoral comme s'il y avait une certaine reconnaissance de la légitimité électorale. Et donc là, ça montre que malgré le fait, encore une fois, qu'on n'a pas eu des bonnes élections au sens de bailleur comme Union européenne, etc., il y a quelque chose qui se passait dans la prise de conscience de la nécessité pour les élections.
A second illustration why, indeed, despite the fact that the international community is convinced that the elections were not the best example, a second example is the involvement of armed groups in the electoral process. One of the criteria internationally is to call elections good elections is the distance between voting stations and armed actors, the army and so on. In the case of Congo, we've seen that armed groups have tried to provide security in order to facilitate people to go voting and also to push people to vote for specific candidates. Again, this is explaining that armed groups, for the first time, see legitimacy in the electoral process itself, which again is sort of a, it sounds very paradoxically that armed groups are actually helping to realize an electoral process and to mobilize the population to participate in the elections.
Oui. En conclusion, qu'est-ce que tout ceci veut dire? Ça veut dire que quand même, premièrement, il y a une sorte de politisation dans la manière dont les populations au niveau local se saisissent des processus qui sont souvent imposés soit par l'État pour leurs intérêts, soit par les bailleurs de fonds comme conditionnalité, en disant ben, « vous devez faire des élections pour avoir de l'aide » ou l'État qui dit « on doit organiser les élections ». On a un discours souvent top-down, et le fait que la population se saisisse de ces discours et le réinterprète est déjà un signe de politisation et de citoyenneté qu'on n'est pas en train de subir, mais qu'on essaie d'adapter au contexte au niveau local.
So, to conclude, the first major conclusion is sort of a politicization of the population. Rather than having these elections being imposed by the state or by donors as a condition to further assistance and a top-down imposition of elections, the Congolese population has reinterpreted the situation, the context, and claimed its right to vote, claimed its citizenship, its citoyenneté, its civicness, I must say, and thus explaining a politicization of the population.
Oui. Et la deuxième chose, et c'est très important, c'est qu'actuellement en Afrique, il y a tous les débats sur la décolonisation, sur le panafricanisme, sur les théories afrocentrées par rapport à des sujets qui sont imposés top-down. Et je pense que les élections sont un cadre, je pense, très intéressant pour voir comment les populations ont compris que le pouvoir en place manipulent ces prescriptions internationales pour leurs intérêts. Et là, on a des cas où quand même, on ne peut plus parler de colonialisme par les élections si on regarde la manière dont la population renverse, réinterprète les impositions des bailleurs de fonds ou de la population. Et donc, les élections ont permis de voir ces manières où on se réapproprie au niveau local les prescriptions des bailleurs de fonds.
So this, the second conclusion is that what we all are aware of this big movement in Africa, but also beyond, about decolonization, pan-Africanism, Afrocentrism, and so on, and this towards this top-down imposition of exported things like elections. Congo's population has understood that those in power have manipulated things like the elections being imposed as conditions by the international community to stay in power, but in the end they have claimed ownership over the process, and rather than having a top-down process, they are imposing a bottom-up process and actually using the same instruments that those being imposed from outside to claim their right to vote and to have a voice in the future of their country.
Enfin, pour finir, à la fin, l'université m'a accepté d'aller au mariage, ce qui est intéressant. Mais après mon doctorat, ils m'ont permis définitivement de rentrer chez moi. Donc le problème de sécurité ne fonctionnait plus. Et tout cela me pousse souvent à se dire que le grand effort à faire pour ces genres de questions sur démocratie, élections, etc., c'est d'essayer de quitter une perspective normative et d'aller vraiment voir sur le terrain ce que ça signifie pour, par rapport au terrain, pour pouvoir être efficace. Sinon, comme disait Deleuze, si on se force à regarder l'autre à partir de ses lunettes, alors on est très loin de l'altérité, on ne peut pas voir l'autre.
So, just to conclude, in the end, I was allowed to go to that marriage, but once I was done with my PhD, my university said I could go back, so security reasons no longer were applicable because I was no longer responsibility for the university didn't feel anymore responsible for my own security. I think that's something we need to discuss at some point here in London as well. But what the key message from this story is that we should leave our normative reading of things like elections and look at what is really going on under underground. If we try to look at realities through our own glasses, we will never encounter what is going on.
Well, thank you. That was absolutely wonderful. And I felt it expressed in a way our philosophy very nicely. You know, that actually what we try to do in the conflict research program is to challenge the dominant imaginary of the conflicts we study and try to bring a perspective that comes much more from the ground, a different perspective. And I've always said, actually, people are always slightly suspicious of me when I say this, that civil society is my methodology, that my methodology is to talk to those kinds of people to get a different kind of understanding of conflict. Anyway, I said we were just going to ask them each a question, and we've ended up taking most of the time. But please, anybody who would like to ask a follow-up question, do. Does anyone? Yes, there's somebody right at the back.
Hi, yes. I'm pleased for our work with DFID on conflict security and justice policy. So, firstly, thank you. This was fascinating. It's great to hear some really compelling stories of how civic society has been shaping politics of the countries that you work in, and well done for your work. What I'm trying to get my head around is what the implications for DFID in the UK more broadly and our work overseas. Is this the kind of space we should be working in, or is it the space that international actors and donors should be for civic society, and we should be operating in other realms? So, my simple question is, if you were sitting in front of our Secretary of State, and you were to say, based on my experience, I think the UK should change by, what would you say?
We've spent the whole day discussing this question, actually. Should I say something, or should we? Who would you?
Maybe you start.
I'll start, but I mean, I think what we came to the conclusion at the end of a whole day is that what's really important is that the UK itself sticks to civic norms. So if it's going to contribute in its foreign policy, which it doesn't always, it makes deals with warlords, for example. And if it's going to support elections, it's got to stick to supporting elections in a serious way. That was the biggest conclusion we came up with. But actually what we've been trying to do all day is think, actually there are civic stories everywhere we look, and all of them face incredible obstacles. I mean, Khalifa talked about all the obstacles that he's faced. And the real question is, and we still haven't got an answer to that, what can be done to lessen those obstacles? It's not so much what can be done to promote civicness, because that's something that's there. And actually, if you pour money at it, you might kill it. But it's how do you dismantle? I mean, we talked some wonderful examples of media, people who really tried to act like honest journalists in Iraq, for example, and they've all faced terrible problems and obstacles. What can be done to lessen those obstacles? And that's what we're in the process of discussing. But I'm sure, I know, who else would like to come back on this question? I'm sure Reem would like to say something.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that can be said about Syria as an example. But let's say, if take the story I told you about the Syrian Civil Society Support Room, right? So the UK is one of the main donors to the Syrian Civil Society organization. And this is one of the best things, I think, that you know the UK does towards Syria. But the civil society role became very political, yeah, when they were nominated to be part of the Constitutional Committee, was the UK there to push the participation of those very same people that the UK was funding? The answer is no. It was not. Who was influencing the composition? It was Turkey and Russia and the regime and the law. Yeah, and most of the European countries were positioning themselves behind the special envoy, yeah, and that was not strong enough. I think we needed them on the table to push for civil society role in crafting its the future of the country, to play a very political role. Because as I said, they are not only just, you know, humanitarian organization, they are people who are very much able to play a political role. And most of the expertise, actually, and the technocrats, and the people who really have like, statesmanship, you find them in the civic arena. You're not going to find them in the opposition or in the regime side. So this is just one example where the support needed is not just, it's not funding. Is really push their political role. You can also, we found lots of civicness in the private sector as well. The private sector isn't famous because of all these, you know, the big sharks who dominate the economy, the crony capitalists who are linked to the regime. But go kind of lower to a lower level at the micro, small, medium level, and you will find lots of business actor whose businesses were destroyed because of the conflict. And I think it's really important to help to revive these small actors, to help to SMEs, because these are the guys who are able to kind of revive the economy in a very legitimate way without being part and parcel of the very corrupt regime. There are things you can do to help regulate the media in the Arab world. I mean, you know, you do great work supporting Syrian media organizations, but we suffer from regional media, the Arab satellite TVs like Al Jazeera and Arabia, which have very sectarian narrative. They do incite violence in their programming and in their language, and they're very they're not regulated. Their only regulation is the policy of the country where they're hosted, right? So this organization, they try to copy the Western model. I mean, watch their program. They try to copy all the world. But the only thing they don't copy is the to be regulated with body like Ofcom, for example, right? Yeah. So you can always promote this. Say, listen, this is how we do things. It's not just about to have a fancy satellite station and guests and people arguing. No, you have to be regulated. You have to be responsible for everything you say. And that's how to do it. That helps the local media organizations a lot, because sometimes 5 seconds on Al Jazeera can ruin everything the Syrian media does, you know, on the ground for years.
I won't immediately go to the others because I think. Oh, okay.
Oui. Oui, juste très, très, très vite. Avant de commencer mon doctorat, j'ai travaillé 8 ans dans la coopération. Je pense qu'il y a souvent un problème de ne pas aller chercher. Je viens de travailler sur un projet à l'est du Congo actuellement. C'est un projet de 30 millions d'euros. J'ai parlé avec l'agence de coopération qui a mis en place ce projet et je me rends compte qu'ils n'ont pas consulté des projets et des recherches qui portent sur ce sujet depuis 15 ans dans la région. Donc le problème aussi, et je le comprends, c'est dans quelle mesure les priorités de DFID, par exemple, sont pensées, les priorités, la mise en œuvre, etc. Et je pense que l'expérience ici, comme le dit Mary tout le temps, le civicness existe sur le terrain. Et je pense qu'il faut aller le chercher et apprendre avant de penser les projets. Et c'est déjà bien que j'ai l'impression que vous collaborez déjà avec des chercheurs. Et je pense que la grande chose à faire, c'est d'abord apprendre avant d'essayer de faire quoi que ce soit.
That was a whole lot. Let me try to be briefly. So Emma said that he has been working prior to his PhD with Development Corporation for 7 or 8 years, and he was just working with a donor agent who trying to develop a $30 million project, but. He discovered that there were no real consultations, research being done on projects and research on these specific topics. While there has been a lot over the last 15 years, so refer to what Mary has been telling the whole day, civicness exists underground rather than develop a project and design it in such a way from a top-down perspective, go and look after it before implementing it. Go and learn from what is in the field and what kind of messages can be taken from the field before trying to think about projects and implement them.
And Khalifa also.
Yeah, I think for Somalia, number one, increase the capacity, well, put more people in the office itself, the DFID office, so that you don't depend on the capacity of the international NGOs and know the impact of your programs yourselves rather than being masked by the international NGOs. I think you wanted to say, you wanted one thing, I think that's the thing.
I do think building research capacity is incredibly important.
Yeah.
And the people who are the researchers do become those, they're not NGOs with an interest in the projects, they're more trying to study the situation. So building local research capacity is hugely important, I think. But now we've gone on and on, and I'm going to take all the questions together and then we'll have a lot. So who else would like to ask a question? Yes, there's a lady right at the back.
Divided civil society, which is so structured along clan lines and structured through that, and I'm sure you have similar things in the other contexts, whether there's ways, whether you see there being ways of overcoming that and ways that that could bridge divides along political lines that you see in Somalia, and there's more that can be done. For example, with the elections coming up, is there more that we should be doing now to be consulted in what civil society can be doing, maybe national dialogue type processes or something where we're trying to do that bottom-up approach despite the fact that it's so segregated from other landlines because of the nature of the hotspot.
Okay, don't answer yet because I just want to see if there are any other questions from people. Nobody else wants to ask anything?
Are you sure?
Okay, you're allowed to answer.
Short, save the money for something else. I don't think you do anything there in the election for civil society. You know. As you say, they are so divided, either with the opposition. I wouldn't say in only the client line, but it's with the opposition or against it. And it's very difficult to find civil society. Civil society in Somalia are always run by people, wrong people really, not civic at all. So,
but are there civic people? Businessmen, doctors? Because today that was...
It's difficult to reach. The real civic people we found are very difficult to reach. And then also the West does not want to deal with them, so that's another problem.
And who are the real civic people?
They're the religious groups, for example.
Yeah.
So you don't want to touch them. So.
I mean, I think what was so interesting today was that we were not hearing so much about civil society as we were hearing about doctors, yeah, teachers, journalists, and also lawyers, yeah, and legal activists. So it was a very different sort of set of people that we were talking about. So, does anyone else? Yeah, come in.
Just un mot sur les élections. Si vous regardez l'expérience en Afrique des Grands Lacs, toutes les élections qu'il y a eu, vous vous rendez compte d'une chose, c'est que les pays occidentaux ont vraiment perdu complètement leur pouvoir d'influencer les élections, et les choses se jouent au niveau de l'Union africaine et de la SADC. Ça ne veut pas dire que les pays comme la Grande-Bretagne ne peuvent pas influencer encore, mais je pense qu'il y a encore du travail à faire dans l'humilité par rapport à ce qu'on peut faire ou ce qu'on ne peut pas faire. Et je pense que par rapport aux élections, comme au Burundi, par exemple, il va y avoir des élections. Et pour l'Union européenne, c'est soit on s'investit parce que tout va être parfait et donc on peut faire quelque chose, soit on laisse tomber. Alors que la réalité est devenue tout à fait différente. Or, il existe quand même, encore une fois, beaucoup d'études sur quelles sont les instances comme les églises, comme des personnes, des journalistes, etc., certains partis politiques, des institutions qu'on peut appuyer pour essayer d'influencer les choses. Et donc, il y a toujours moyen de toucher quelque part, mais pour autant qu'on prend le temps de se rendre compte de ce qu'on est devenu et qu'on trouve des solutions locales.
Briefly, what we can learn from elections in Africa is that we should downsize our ambitions and that Western countries have lost their ability to control electoral processes, including the UK, which doesn't mean that nothing can be done. But again, references made by Ma to existing material, existing studies, which tell us which kind of organizations can have an influence on electoral processes, whether it are churches or civil society organizations and so on. So rather than trying to have an impact on electoral processes directly, which is not going to happen anymore, it would be more interesting to identify actors, organizations, which can have an influence on electoral processes.
And who else would like to say a final word? Would anybody like to say a final word?
I just again stress the importance of research. Not just researching civil society in conflict, but the research with civil society, the methodology that Mary spoke about. I mean, we found that some of the most, for example, we have a CRP blog, and we often, you know, write ourselves in this blog, but the most popular blogs are the ones written from the researchers on the ground. These are the ones that get circulated more often, because we bring an independent perception and experience of the conflict from the ground, from civil society. So they're mainly written by the researchers we work with. So I think supporting research that is connected to the ground, treating people as part of the research, not just as a subject of the research, is extremely important.
And actually, and maybe Kuhn would like to add something.
Yeah.
You know, that they've had a wonderful initiative at Ghent of a blog about which a blog site from their researchers on the ground, which they've now published as a book called Silent Voices. Mm-hmm. And you might like to...
Thank you, yeah, that's a great opportunity, actually. some publicity at the end. We're reaching 8 o'clock. So for the last 2 years, we've been working very intensively, and we meaning 30 researchers based in Bukavu and around Bukavu, and a number of people based in Belgium, including Emma. And we have been thinking about the position of local researchers. One of the messages from this panel is that we should listen to local voices, to local experiences, and so on. And we have been discussing how people who are often recruited by us, by DFID, by other organizations, as research assistants, how they have lived these experiences, which is not necessarily a very beautiful story. We've come up with a lot of very frustrating stories, but also a number of stories explaining how difficult it has been to work in extremely difficult and dangerous environments, often without payment, without a contract, and in the end remaining extremely invisible in the final product. In the best case, research assistants are mentioned in a footnote. In the worst case, they are not even mentioned anywhere in the report. So they went, and we've been working a lot on this, and finally we started writing blogs on, and we've published quite a few already on the website, but we've also put them in a small book, which is here now, the Bukavu series towards the decolonization of research. I think it's a quite unique thing. It's been 20 years I've been working in Congo, and I'm really proud of this, because these are voices from the field, people telling us how they experience research. We think about and also for the CRP, for instance, there is a research agenda, but many of local researchers say, what is the relevance of all this? There's so many other things that go unnoticed. So they tell about these stories. Unfortunately, the version we have is only in French, but there will be an English version very soon. And I think Azaria is working already on an event early May, because we also included a number of cartoons on the topics of and positionality and emotional stress and so on. And we might exhibit these cartoons from early May onwards, at least. Fingers crossed, we will know this week if LSE wants to fund this project. But so, anyone in that commission, please.
I think just I will say as a very final word that I feel after having been involved in these DFID funded programs now for nearly 10 years, that actually we're always being asked to tell about our impact, and usually what people mean by impact is how we influence the policymakers. But my view is that those researchers we've worked with have made a real impact on the ground. I mean, we have concrete examples, whether it's the court monitors in Somalia and South Sudan, but more importantly, they represent a civic constituency themselves.
Exactly.
And I think that's incredibly important and powerful. So anyway, thank you very much, everybody, and hope we'll see you again at a future event. I think that went really well.